I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, Obama says the Syrian government has lost its legitimacy. An Amnesty International spokesman endorses the standing man style of protest in Turkey. A military attack on Iran may be the worst policy option.
I fear that a military strike will produce the very thing you're trying to avoid, which is the Iranian government would meet the day after that attack and said, oh yeah, we'll show you, we're going to build a nuclear weapon.
And Luxor is in a fury over a new governor with terror links. It's all ahead. U.S. President Barack Obama said the Syrian government has lost its legitimacy by killing tens of thousands of its citizens in a bloody civil war. He spoke during a joint news conference Wednesday with German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
We want a Syria that is peaceful, non-sectarian, democratic, legitimate, tolerant. You know, that is our overriding goal. We want to end the bloodshed. We want to make sure that chemical weapons are not used and that chemical weapons do not fall into the hands of people who would be willing to use them. It's also been our view that the best way to get there is through a political transition. And we said that a year ago. We said that 2 years ago. President Assad made a different decision and has brought chaos and bloodshed to his country has been killing his own people. And it is our view that it is not possible for him to regain legitimacy after over 100,000 people have been killed and millions have been displaced inside the country. So the question now is just as a practical matter, and this is what I said to President Putin, as a practical matter, if in fact Syria is to remain a unified country and the bloodshed is going to end, how do we do that? The only way to do that is through some sort of political transition process. And the good news out of the G8 meeting was is that you saw all the countries, including Russia, reaffirming the communique coming out of the first Geneva talks that said we need to create a transitional governing body with full powers. The second good thing that came out of the G8 discussions was that all of us, including Russia, said we have to investigate use of chemical weapons inside of Syria, and all the parties, including the government of Bashar al-Assad, have to cooperate with that investigation. We're confident that, in fact, the government has used chemical weapons. The Russians are skeptical. We said, fine, let's have the United Nations get in there, but do a serious investigation of it, because we don't want anybody using chemical weapons.
Mr. Obama said reports the United States is heading into a new Middle Eastern war by aiding the rebels in Syria were exaggerated.
How can we continue to support a political opposition and a military opposition that becomes more capable, becomes more unified, that isolates extremists who have incorporated themselves into the opposition forces inside of Syria, so that if, in fact, and when we get a political transition, there's somebody there who can take over and function in governing and lead to a better future for all Syrians. That's a difficult process. It's not one that's happening overnight. But all the assistance that we are providing, both to the political and military opposition, is designed for that purpose. Some of the stories that have been out there publicly have, I think, gotten a little overcranked in terms of the idea that somehow the United States is preparing to go all in and participate in another war. What we want to do is end a war, but the only way it's going to end is if, in fact, we have the kind of transition that I described. And although you're right that at this point President Putin believes that what would replace Assad would be worse than Assad himself, what I think will become more and more apparent over the coming weeks and months is that without a different government, you can't bring peace, and in fact, you're going to see sectarian divisions get worse and worse and start spilling over into the other parts of the region, and that would be good for nobody.
President Obama speaking in Berlin. The Syrian situation is a game changer in the world refugee picture, according to the UN. Marking World Refugee Day, a new UN report finds more than 45.2 million people worldwide were forcibly displaced in 2012. The highest number since 1994. The UNHCR says more than half of all refugees come from Syria, Afghanistan, Somalia, Iraq, and Sudan. And by the end of 2012, some 650,000 refugees had fled the Syrian conflict into neighboring countries. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres.
We have now more than 1.6 million, as you know. which means that the number of refugees that fled from Syria since the 1st of January is more or less of the same amount of the total number of refugees that fled all over the world during 2012. This gives you an idea of how dramatic the Syrian crisis is.
UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards tells VOA, conflict is the primary cause of displacement.
Over the last year in particular, the big game changer has been Syria. Syria went from being the major refugee hosting country of the Middle East to last year being one of the top five refugee and displacement producing countries of the world. This year, it's number one. That's a very alarming turnaround, and that makes a big change in the global displacement picture.
Edwards says the drama of crises like that occurring in Syria tend to eclipse other ongoing crises. Marches that began 3 weeks ago in Turkey and against plans to destroy a public park in Istanbul soon grew into protests against Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The opposition accuses the Prime Minister of trying to impose his conservative Islamist views on a secular state. He denies this and says the demonstrators are being manipulated by terrorists. Police used tear gas and water cannons to break up the demonstrations. Some marchers threw rocks and gasoline bombs. At least 4 people have been killed and 7,500 hurt. Amnesty International has a staff on the ground monitoring the situation in Turkey. We spoke with Amnesty's Bill Jones about the unrest.
We've had gross violations of the rights of peaceful assembly and freedom of expression. We've had a large number of people arrested under the anti-terrorism laws, which is quite upsetting since these laws are not in conformity with international standards. We've also had the indiscriminate use of water cannon and tear gas, including tear gassing in small spaces, including the direct firing of tear gas canisters at people. This has resulted in, we've had reports that at least 12 people have lost an eye from this. There are many have had broken limbs. Those are Amnesty's concerns. My assessment of whether this will continue is anybody's guess, but it does not look like, given the statements by the Prime Minister so far, that there will be any abatement.
And we should mention that the protesters haven't been completely peaceful themselves.
This is true, but from the reports we've received from our people on the ground, this is a very small minority of the protesters. And I think it should be pointed out that this began with an entirely peaceful protest that was disrupted by water cannons and tear gassing to clear Gezi Park back in, when was it, May 29th, I believe. And it was the excessive use of force against these peaceful protesters, which apparently caused more and more people to come to the streets.
What would you like to see done?
What I would like to see done was, first of all, of course, a stop to excessive force against people. I would like to see more freedom of expression in Turkey. I would also like to see the people who have committed excesses on both sides to be held accountable, and this includes the police force, of course, and brought to justice.
Recently, there have been some silent protests in Turkey where people would stand motionless for hours at a time. And Turkey's deputy prime minister has said that he doesn't object to the silent anti-government protests. What is your reaction to that?
The Duran Adam, as they say in Turkey, the standing man. Just personally, I find it a brilliant form of protest. And also, I want to point out, though, that when this was first used in Taksim Square, a number of people joined silently and were arrested. They were later released, and the Prime Minister has said that he will not tolerate any demonstrations in Taksim Square. Now, again, I think it's a great form of protest. We'll see how it evolves. It has apparently gone viral. It's been all over the social media. It's been in the press. I'm sure you've seen pictures of it as well.
Well, do you think this is a form of protest that maybe people in other countries should imitate?
I think any form of protest that's nonviolent and effective should certainly be emulated.
Bill Jones, chairman of Amnesty International's Turkey Coordination Group. The United States and the European Union believe Iran is seeking to develop nuclear weapons, but Tehran says its program is for peaceful civilian purposes. In this report from Washington, VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshra looks at the least desirable policy option available to the United States and Israel, a military strike against Iran's suspected nuclear weapons sites.
The international community has been trying for years to persuade Iran to end its uranium enrichment program, but to no avail. Low-enriched uranium can be used for civilian nuclear power plants, but highly enriched uranium is an integral part of a nuclear bomb. In an effort to pressure Tehran to end its enrichment program, the UN Security Council has imposed sanctions on Iran. And several individual nations, such as the United States, have imposed their own measures, for example, targeting Tehran's oil industry and financial sector. In addition, two rounds of international negotiations held this year failed to yield any progress. But some analysts believe there may be a chance for movement with the election of moderate cleric Hassan Rouhani as Iran's new president. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, however, says the international community must not engage in what he called wishful thinking about Iran's leadership. Israel considers a nuclear-armed Iran to be an existential threat, and it has hinted that it is capable of carrying out a military strike against Iran's nuclear facilities to make sure Iran does not build a bomb. Military analyst Paul Rogers of Britain's Bradford University says the Israelis are faced with a difficult task.
The Iranians have been quite dedicated in recent years in putting a proportion of their nuclear facilities quite deep underground, probably too deep for the Israelis to hit. The U.S. Air Force now does have a very powerful new deep bunker buster, but there's no indication that it is willing to give that to Israel. It's given other medium-level bunker busters to Israel, but not the really powerful one, the massive earth penetrator.
National Defense University military expert Thomas Hamas says the Iranian targets must be well-defined.
This makes the huge assumption that we know where these facilities are. Remember, we invaded Iraq because we were sure there were weapons of mass destruction there, and we knew exactly where some of them were, and we were right 0% of the time.
Hamas asks if the U.S. intelligence capability has improved so much in the last 10 years. Former U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker, whose foreign posts included Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Syria, says if there is going to be any military action, it must be successful.
The only thing worse than an Iran with nuclear weapons would be an Iran with nuclear weapons that one or more countries attempted to prevent them from obtaining by military strikes and failed.
A Massachusetts Institute of Technology expert on Iran's nuclear program, Jim Walsh, says military action against Iran might be counterproductive.
I fear that a military strike will produce the very thing you're trying to avoid, which is the Iranian government would meet the day after that attack and said, oh yeah, we'll show you, we're going to build a nuclear weapon. I think you will get a weapons decision following an attack, which is the last thing we want to produce right now.
Many governments and analysts say a nuclear-armed Iran is unacceptable. But Thomas Hamas at the National Defense University takes another view.
We certainly lived with a nuclear-armed Soviet Union for a long time. We are currently living perhaps with a nuclear-armed North Korea, and we are with a nuclear-armed China. So the presence of nuclear arms does not necessarily mean you can't live with or operate with a country. I don't understand what makes Iran so much more dangerous with a nuclear weapon.
Hamas says if Iran ever manufactures nuclear weapons and decides to fire them, Israel will probably destroy that country. If not Israel, says Hamas, then the United States probably will. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
Opponents and supporters in the tourist city of Luxor remain in a standoff over a newly appointed governor tied to the group accused of a terror attack there in 1997. VOA's Elizabeth Errett reports from Cairo. The incident highlights growing nationwide political chasms ahead of planned anti-government protests later this month.
Supporters and opponents of the new Islamist governor of Luxor remain outside government headquarters in the tourist city. A spokesman for Adil Mohammed Al-Hayat says the governor hopes to talk to his detractors soon. Badawi Al-Masri, head of media for the Luxor government, says Al-Hayat wants to explain his plans to develop the region and push the development of tourism. Tourist workers and others are furious over the appointment of Al-Hayat, who hails from Gamaat Islamiya, the group accused of carrying out the grisly massacre in Luxor in 1997 of 4 Egyptians and 58 foreign tourists, including a 5-year-old boy. Egypt's tourism minister Hisham Zazu tendered his resignation over the appointment, though he remains at his post. Luxor's historic environs include the Temple of Karnak and the Pharaonic tombs of the Valley of the Kings. Al-Hayat has denied any involvement in the attack, which appalled the Egyptian public and prompted Gamaat Islamiya to renounce violence. Mohammed Bakr of the Luxor branch of Gamaat Islamiya's political wing says the group remains committed to peace. Bakr says people are calling his group terrorists with violent tendencies, but argues if that were true, they would have clashed with the governor's opponents. The leadership, he says, decided not to. But critics argue that the appointment shows not just a disregard for the group's violent past, but of some members' condemnation of Egypt's pharaonic pre-Islamic monuments as idolatry. Political analyst Hisham Qasim.
It gave a terrible message that the Muslim Brotherhood government are against tourism for simply appointing somebody who believes that monuments are idols and that they should be demolished.
Luxor spokesman Al-Masri says Hayat's past comments about idolatry have been exaggerated. But Qasim also believes the government may have had the context of the nation's deep polarization in mind when giving the post to an Islamist rival. He notes the calls for early elections and mass demonstrations against President Mohamed Morsi on June 30th.
It's a clear message. They're splitting things among the different Islamic factions, hoping that they will support them in their upcoming battle with more or less the Egyptian nation.
If so, any gain in support may likely be offset by the furor among the residents of Luxor. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.